to the New Zealand International Film Festival. A few weeks ago, David Zellner, the co-writer and director of a film in the festival called Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, was in Sydney for the Sydney Film Festival, and he was very kind to give up an afternoon there to talk to a whole lot of us New Zealand media. And so that conversation follows. I should point out that the interview was done at my day job, and I forgot to take the phone off them. So about halfway through, the phone rings, and I have no bucket of water to throw it in.
But that's what people love about your show, that it's homespun, that it's real, it's organic.
And we don't plan. So all of that. So anyway, David Zellner. David Zellner, you're the co-writer and director of Kumiko the Treasure Hunter. Welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Hi, happy to be here.
First of all, congratulations, and nice work in front of the camera as well as behind it.
Thanks, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's my brother and I always tend to both wear multiple hats with our work when appropriate, and it was fun doing it on this as well.
It's more than just a cameo, isn't it? Your role, it's pretty crucial.
Yeah, and we from the writing stage, we kind of work around our, if there's a character we're going to play, we kind of work around our strengths. And and it can be kind of obnoxious for filmmakers to be both actors and filmmakers. So if we're going to have the audacity to do that, we need to make sure it's something that we can do and that we're going to do a good job at, or we deserve more flack than anyone. So we make sure it's something that we can nail appropriately.
All right. Now, your film seems to deal quite a lot with, I guess, urban myth-making versus reality. The legend of Fargo inspires a Japanese woman to travel the world, and then, but your film itself is based on a story where many of the actual details are murky. Tell us a little bit about how the idea came to you and how you managed to develop it into a film.
The story first came about in 2001, and based on what we were exposed to. It was just message boards online. This was before Facebook and Twitter, and it was just initially a random bit of information about a Japanese woman, leaving her home in Tokyo, going on a quest for the mythical fortune from the film, and it really piqued our interest and was so strange and mysterious to us. One, because there was a lack of information about it initially. It seems everything about it seems so antiquated. The idea of someone going on a quest for a fortune across the globe seemed like something from the age of exploration. Something that conquistadors did. And in this day and age where information is so readily available, via the internet, where that there's no mysterious uncharted lands.
No, and our dreams can be shot down so easily.
Yeah. And so we like the idea of this from this perspective where there's a sense of mystery and of the unknown. And I loved having it in this contemporary context. And so, so we built the story based on, just at the satiated our own curiosity, we built it based on that. And then, interestingly enough, over time, more details, factual details emerged that were less sensational, less fantastical, and more of just like something tragic you'd see in the news. But what drew us to the story in the first place was the fable-like quality of it. And then, when it turned out to be, when the lines between fact and fiction and the truthfulness of it became blurred, initially we were caught off guard, but then it made us excited because it added a certain, that kind of fit the story and added a certain level of complexity to it, and it was the myth that drew us to the material in the first place.
It's a tremendously effective movie that you've made. It's also a very beautiful movie to look at. Was it a hard movie to pitch to people in terms of actually getting support, getting funding for it?
Yes, it was. It took a really long time to get off the ground. I mean, it had a you know, had a lot of things it's a very unique film, and which in a lot of ways is a strength, and then in others it makes it harder for people, you know, to get behind, because it doesn't fit into a easy, you know, genre, especially when just from simply pitching a story. So it, you know, it took a while. The fact that it's in two different languages, shooting in two different parts of the world, that it's weather dependent. We wanted the environment in both Japan and America, and in Minnesota, we very wanted those landscapes to essentially be characters in the film. And so we needed, you know, to utilize them to the fullest extent. And in Minnesota, that meant having the harshest weather possible. And so having everything time out right, with both weather and location and everything like that ended up, taking a good while.
And I would imagine that your lead actress, Rinko Kikuchi, I imagine trying to fit her schedule in, because she's an extraordinary actress, but also quite a powerhouse in her own right in Japan.
Absolutely, yeah. No, she's an incredible talent. We're really fortunate to have worked with her, and it took. And really, as far as I'm concerned, there's no one else that could have done the role as well as her. She's the perfect person for it. Having her schedule work with ours was another thing, that having everything line up perfectly.
She's an executive producer of the film as well. So did she come on board early?
She was on board before, you know. It took a while to get off the ground, obviously, but and we knew for a while before we filmed that we wanted her, but it was simply having everything line up with her filming schedule working out with when we were able to go into production with everything else.
You've got, there's one other, there are two other executive producers, but one I want to mention, Alexander Payne, famous for The Descendants, obviously, Sideways, and Nebraska as well. What does an executive producer like that do for you?
In that case, nothing directly, it's more of a peripheral stamp of approval, which was, that here in this company, it's seen our previous work. And really liked the script, and so it was just it was a nice stamp of approval, in the process of us making it.
Does he help open doors for you, or is it just a name that you can say, well, look, this guy trusts us?
Yeah, it's more of that, exactly.
How long did you spend in Japan before, like during the development process? Because there's a lot of the film is set in Japan, and there are a lot of not obvious perspectives in there that it seems like somebody would have to have spent time getting to know the place but still be a bit of a stranger.
I'd been there as a tourist I really love Japan and the people and the culture, and then that's part, I'm sure on some level that's what it helped attract us to this story. The last thing we wanted is it to look like a couple of white guys from Texas, made it. And so we wanted to be, conscious of how we, how we were, portraying the culture and the world that she inhabited. That said, there's obviously, like all films, there's a significant stylization to it, but we wanted, we didn't want it to feel touristy, We wanted it to feel like this was her world we're inhabiting. And when we, worked with the people and the crew in Japan, it was a bilingual, but all Japanese crew. They helped us along with that part of the process. And they were glad that we were, interested in locations and places that were not the normal thing you would see in a Western film.
The lead character played by Rinko Kikuchi, she obviously doesn't fit into mainstream Japanese culture. Did you find that that particular portrayal, I guess, of Japan as it is now, by outsiders such as yourself? How has that gone down?
I think one of the most gratifying things in finishing the film and getting out there is having Japanese audience members, you know, come up and say how much they like that depiction. We just try to do as much of our homework, in terms of a certain truthfulness to the world she inhabited that also lent itself well to this story. I mean, like, you know, a big part of Japan of the Japan segment involves her work life with the office lady culture, which is dying out, but is still very much there. And I just had done a good amount of research on that, and it lent itself well to a sort of an oppressive environment that she felt trapped in.
And then you get to Minnesota, snowy Minnesota, and you realize as an audience member that basically everywhere is strange if you look at it from the right angle. And you've provided a perspective on sort of the Midwest there that is not a very film crews don't get there very often, do they? I mean, you're thinking about sort of apart from Fargo and maybe Nebraska and the other Payne films, they seem to be sort of left behind. And I mean, there's still lots of angles there to present to the world.
Yeah, and we wanted. It's from everything in the film is from her perspective, and we wanted that to be portrayed, in every way from her performance, from the way we shot the film, to the sound design and scoring, all from her perspective, in terms of this kind of sense of isolation and alienation, and because of that, there are things that might be banal, very normal to other people. We wanted to be very, very foreign and mysterious to her, and that was obviously very amped up as she, traversed through the American landscape.
Yeah,
and encountered the different kinds of people there.
Yeah, not just the different kind of people. Excuse me, I'll just my other phone ringing. I will try and turn that off. Luckily, we'll be able to edit that out. Throw it into a bucket of water or something like that. Crumbs. So I'm working. This is it. I'm in my day job office.
No problem.
Right. So I just wanted to ask you and your brother are Austin-based filmmakers. What does that mean to be an Austin-based filmmaker? Like, is there a Texas scene or an Austin scene?
Yeah, it's a really, and particularly right now, it's a really vibrant scene. It's a really interesting time, and there's a lot of filmmakers based there making very very interesting and relevant work right now. And it's not the kind of thing you can force or plan. It just happens organically. But it's just one day you look up and realize that there's a lot of great talents, in this filmmaking scene, and all fighting the good fight for trying to make, new and relevant work.
Are you being called to either coast, do you think? Do you see a transition in your future?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I love New York and LA, and I love Austin. Who knows?
David Zellner, thanks for visiting with us at Rancho Notorious. We really appreciate you stopping by. And good luck with Kimiko the Treasure Hunter on its tour around the world.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
How long have you been here, son? Just started, eh?
Yes, sir. 7 years ago.
Yeah, no, the creepy guy's here again.
Hi, creepy guy.
Have you spoken to the new employee?
James. Yeah, sure, a minute.
But did you notice anything strange about him? I mean, did he remind you of anyone?
Who did you have in mind?
Simon, how come you don't have a girlfriend?
I don't know. There's someone I've been thinking about. I have all these things that I want to say to her. I know what it feels like to be lost and lonely and invisible. You have to go after what you want.
You really think she's looking at me?
Yeah.
All right, now lick your lips.
Yeah.
What? Show the tongue, but be careful not to look like a lizard. Go.
That's a little bit of the trailer of the double Richard Ayoade's one of two films in the festival on the subject of doppelgangers.
When's Richard Ayoade coming to New Zealand? That's my question.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. He would be a great Q&A topic, wouldn't he?
He'd be great just to be hanging out with us on the podcast. Just saying, if you're listening.
Look, now, the reason why we're doing this now is largely for totally selfish reasons. One is that normally around this time of year, I would be writing my 1,000-word preview of the film festival and putting it on the blog with links and all the rest of the yada, yada, yada. But anyway, today I got told that I have glandular fever and that I should be doing less work, not more. So in order to still do right by the film festival, who lent me all of these... screeners. We're gonna do it here.
Nude.
We're gonna busk it.
It is not nude.
Not nude. No.
Well, they're not. Okay, fair enough.
Because we don't all want glandular fever.
No, exactly. That's why I'm on one side of the room. Everybody else is on the other side of the room, and we're not sharing microphones.
No pashing.
We're not sharing pop screens.
Talk to us now, Dan. We can hear.
Anyway, so in an effort to try and do the right thing by everybody, here we go. But I've actually watched a lot the last week or so. So here we go. With a little bit of help from my friends, if you could just throw some titles at me and I'll tell you what my impressions are.
Okay, I'm going to go from random order from this list.
Yeah,
ready?
Yep.
Hard to be a God.
Hard to be a God. Okay, Hard to be a God is a black and white Russian science fiction movie, which isn't really science fiction. It's based on a novel, and it's imagining a situation where scientists from the present day have traveled to another planet which is further behind us in development. They're like still stuck in the dark ages,
right.
And the idea is that they will be able to go and try and provoke them into becoming into a renaissance, with what they know.
So the scientists become gods.
That's exactly right.
You see, that's just nerd fantasy.
Right, it is.
But we'll meet hot chicks and be in charge of them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The problem is that they've given themselves some certain rules, and that is that they're not allowed to kill people, and then there's certain limits to their interference. And as a result, they have no impact on the society whatsoever. And it basically remains the Dark Ages. And I got to watch half an hour of this out of this like nearly 3 hour film, maybe over 3 hour film. It was all I could manage. This was a proof, if ever. Whatever proof was needed that the film festival is still as dedicated to the cutting edge of art house that it ever was. This is a film that would, I think,
is
test
it a Russian
the
film?
It's a Russian film, and very Russian.
Yep.
And I think it would reward the patience of those people who perhaps stick it out to the end. Unfortunately, I had about 8 films that I needed to watch this weekend, and so couldn't. I got a little bit tired of the basic obsession with toilets that, I was like, I've seen enough of that. Thank you very much. And
wow,
let's move
on. In the first half hour.
In the first half hour. It was like, I can see your theme here.
If we're going to do Dunnies for 3 hours, basically you don't want Russian ones.
No, exactly. So
just a word of warning.
I spoke to Bill Gosden, the director of the festival, about this, and I said, look, this is doing my head in, actually. And he did say, apparently it's much better if you've read the book, so there you go.
All right, people, get reading.
Yeah.
Sepida, Reaching for the Stars.
Oh, this is good. Mm. This is one we actually watched this with the 11-year-old who lives with us, and because we were trying to find, of all of the screeners that we've been given and the options we've been given, films that were okay for family viewing. Not many, has to be said. But anyway, so we watched this one, and he got a really big kick out of this. It's about a teenage Iranian girl who lives in the provinces in Iran, not even in the city, who is obsessed with astronomy. It's a documentary, John.
I have heard of such a thing.
Yeah. And so it's true, John. Really.
Whoa.
Happened. And she, inspired by the first woman space tourist, who was an Iranian, who led, shows that it's possible for a young Iranian woman to actually become an astronaut. She is determined to try and pursue those goals and become a great astronomer as well as an astronaut. And you get to see the access that these filmmakers have got to the families involved is like, why didn't these people just tell them to piss off? Because it's quite, you know, intrusive where they, and this is Iran, you know, they got, it's not like they're used to reality television and becoming famous or the rest of it. I would have just told them to bugger off. But anyway.
You can't do that. Luckily, as a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah,
you can't change.
Once they're there.
Yeah. You can't change things.
So it was a terrific film, actually, and we were really inspired by her and really kind of saddened by the choices that she ends up having to make in order to achieve her goals. But yeah, Sepede, really, really good.
Hmm. Speaking of women in movies, 52 Tuesdays.
52 Tuesdays. I got to finish this one today, actually. And 52 Tuesdays is a heck of a film. By golly. This one is really, really interesting. South Australian Film Corporation. So yet another really interesting film coming out of Adelaide in South Australia. This is a film... it's about? It's... essentially, a point of view coming of age movie about a teenage girl whose mother is going through a sex change transition into becoming a man, and it's following a whole year of their relationship and this teenage girl, the challenges that not just those changes, but the changes going on in her life and with her father and with her best friends at school. And I thought it was just incredibly sensitive to everybody's situation. I thought it was incredibly enlightening for me as somebody who knows nothing about that situation. Mm. And I thought that it was really, really well performed by everybody. And the young girl playing the teenage lead is going to be an absolute megastar. She is going to be the next Nicole Kidman and, you know, like another or Mia Wasikowska or, you know, those that production line of Australian amazingness. Mm. She's definitely on it. 52 Tuesday, it was just a terrific film. If I have one problem with it would be that it really is too long. Like it doesn't bear up to being two hours plus.
Sure. Sounds quite brave in its ambitions.
Very ambitious, yeah. And very, yeah, very respectful. And and I think perhaps that's what leads to its length to a degree.
Mm. And it was actually shot on consecutive Tuesdays.
Yeah, and it shows, and you can see that the relationships between everybody and it just does a fantastic job of showing the time passing, which is obviously, you know, not quite boyhood, which does it even. I know you're not a big fan, but anyway,
it was great. Actually, the more I read about boyhood, the more I like it.
Yeah,
but great film. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
Hodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah, now this Hodorowsky's Dune. Now this is a really interesting.
I would look for. I haven't seen it, but I so want to see it because it's great.
I know, and
I'm a huge sci-fi fan. So
if I was an anime character, I've been watching a lot of Sailor Moon. I would totally have hard eyes right now, thinking about this film.
And your eyes get really big instead of
big hearts. Big hearts.
Well, unfortunately, Johnny, you only arrived in town on Sunday night, and we watched it on Saturday night, unfortunately. But it was you guys are probably a bigger audience for this movie than I was. Like I tried to read the book Dune when I was young, and it did nothing for me. And that the David Lynch movie was just a farrago. And Jodorowsky, you know, I've watched Holy Mountain, but I haven't seen any of his other films. And you know, and he's nuts. Right, and his nutsness only, like, for the first half of the film, you think this is a reasonable old man. He's 78 years old. It's like, he's you know, and then about halfway through, his eyes get really wide, as you would imagine.
Sure,
and he just starts to say some really outrageous things. And this is a film that they basically storyboarded to such a degree that there are two remaining copies that exist of the full storyboard of the entire thing, plus all of the character designs, plus all of the set work that was done. And so you can read it.
Yeah.
You can read it like a comic book. And actually, he and Moebius, the French illustrator who did all of those, did all of the artwork, they ended up going, well, bugger Hollywood, we're never going to get a film made, let's just make comic books. And that's what they did for the next 20 years.
Because, I mean, he managed to interest them. I mean, you may say he's he's mad as a goose, but he managed to interest Orson Welles. This is all in the 70s, we should point out. That's when he was trying
he managed to persuade Salvador Dali.
Salvador Dali, you know, Geiger, who went, you know, I mean, these weren't no small artists. I mean, these were
the film, and what the film manages to point out, which is that actually people like Geiger, you know, had never thought about working in film before.
Who passed away recently?
He did, but he'd never thought about working in film before. And the final section of the film is the legacy of Dune, and the fact that so many of those people got to work on Alien, and there's this actually there's a little montage section of films inspired by it, or that possibly were inspired by Dune, because of course they left this book behind at every studio.
Don't spoil it. That was an amazing revelation.
I won't, exactly.
But, gotta have a montage.
but I have to say that some of those films in that montage weren't very good. You know, you'd have to say, it's like, really, you inspired that? You taking credit for that? Don't. But anyway, look, I have to say it was kind of interesting, but it's not the I didn't
more
fall
interesting idea.
For it. Yeah, well, I didn't fall for it the way that some people have, because it's not my scene. Yeah.
It's a little more fascinating in a way that what was Terry Gilliam's one about making Don Quixote, Lost in La Mancha, you know.
Yeah, and actually, that's a really interesting parallel you've just made there, because the one thing that this
we tried
film
to make it, yeah, but we couldn't.
But this one thing that this film doesn't do, and that Jodorowsky doesn't really do, is he never really explains why. You know, it's like, why should I care that this film was never made? Why? What have I lost emotionally, or what have I lost in terms of the big grand themes? It's like he just saw, like, I mean, he was asked by a producer, what do you want to do next? And the word Dune popped into his head because he just read the book. Or he hadn't even read the book. He'd heard of the book. And it's like, this is my chance to make something really, really big with really, really big money.
Sure.
But at no point does he say, you know, I think the spice is a metaphor for such and such, or I think that this is about the human condition or any of that. So it's like, I just want to have fun. I just want to, like Orson Welles said when he first made Citizen Kane, you know, making a film is like the biggest train set a young man was ever given, you know.
how old was he when he made that?
Exactly. And so 20s. That's what Jodorowsky, you know, it's like, let's have the most fun that we can possibly have. And it's the 70s and they're all stoned. So, you know, but what's it all about? Doesn't really come through.
I thought it did.
I mean, I think the parallels too with Guillermo del Toro, what he's made here, The Mountains of Madness, you know, the H.P. Lovecraft thing, and I'm a huge H.P. Lovecraft
fan.
I would have loved to have seen his realization.
Well, he's just announced that he's going to make two versions of that now. He's going to make a PG version and an R version, because the reason why he couldn't make that was because no one would give him the money to do it unless it was PG. So he's going to do. So he's now finally worked out a deal where he can do a PG version, which means that he can get it funded, and an R version, which will be the director's cut, the vision.
H.P. Lovecraft, that mad old New England.
The goose.
Speaking of big questions, is The Man Who Is Tall happy?
All right, well, this is talking of 70, no, even older, 84-year-old people who you could listen to talk all day. Noam Chomsky, one of the great intellectuals of our time, not just the most profound thinker on linguistics that the world has ever known, but also a really remarkable thinker about world affairs and politics and society. Michel Gondry, the great French director, spent a few hours with him and recorded the conversations, and has turned the film into an animated exploration, I guess, of Chomsky's thoughts and feelings. And
wow, yeah. I didn't know he was still recording. He must be very elderly now.
Well, he's still going to work. He's still teaching at MIT, right? And he's still sharp as a tack. In terms of his thought. In fact, if anything, he's still operating at such a high level that I understood almost nothing of that film. It was, and no matter how much Gondry tried to explain stuff through his beautiful, clever animation, most of it, you know, I'm a bright guy, right? But a lot of it still went sailing over my head. But I have to say that it's still a really interesting film and a really pleasurable film to experience, because the animation is so cool and you can just listen to Chomsky talk. He's just got this lovely voice.
It's a measured voice. It talks about panic. And then the US destroyed all these people, and then they killed them all, and then they, well, of course, we installed a puppet government in Nicaragua. And, you know, but it's not malice.
Freaky.
There's no malice behind it.
No, exactly. It's just intellectual truth.
And I remember when manufacturing consent came out all those years ago. I mean, that's how long he's... it's not even his area of specialty. So I don't know why
he's a linguist.
If you want to talk about linguistic, I'm happy, but I don't understand why you're asking about world affairs. I mean, everyone knows this, don't they? Well, you know, it turned out not everyone did.
Back in the day, I used to... before I ran the Paramount Movie Theatre and I worked at the Paramount Movie Theatre under... You know, this is many, many years ago. We played Manufacturing Consent and we played it for weeks and weeks and weeks. It was just one of the... I would be amazed if there isn't a politically aware person in New Zealand of a certain age that hasn't been influenced by Manufacturing Consent and Chomsky. And
if you haven't seen it, check it out.
Well, yeah. It's actually quite hard to find now, but...
There's a more recent one, isn't there? Power and Corruption?
Yeah, Power and Corruption. Yeah, but if people are going to this film expecting Chomsky's politics, they're going to be a little bit disappointed because this is very much about very, very high-level ideas about language construction and how... And how language is made, and he's operating on a level that
is language innate. I suppose is what he's
look. I'm not even gonna try and pin this stuff down for you because seriously, it just went in one eye and out the other, which in a really pleasant way, I have to say.
And if you'd like more Chomsky in your New Zealand Film Festival, there's also Notes to Eternity by Sarah Corduroy. It's a New Zealand film. It's in the Champions section, and it's a more political. Political film with his political speaking, so you can double up on your Chomsky. Speaking of double ups, let's go The Devil and the Enemy back to back.
Yeah, well, unlike the festival itself, who the way things are scheduled, this is very difficult to do. Johnny and I, we managed to have an actual double feature of Doppelgangers.
Yes.
So we watched The Double first, the Richard Ayoade film, and then the film Enemy, by Denis Villeneuve, with Jake Gyllenhaal. So Johnny, The Double, we sat and watched it, and we went, "Oh, this guy's. We know what this guy's been watching."
Well, I mean, it's funny that we thought that. I just looked at the press program now, and the two films, you know, Brazil jumped out, also Elephant Man, from David Lynch and stuff. But I also felt a bit of Fight Club in there for me.
Well, definitely thematically a bit of Fight Club. You know, you're talking about two sides of one personality, an ego and an id or whatever. And so we've got this character played by Jesse Eisenberg who has a dead end job in an office and no one sees him, and he has to sign in every day because the security guard doesn't recognize him, etc.
But very metaphor for modern life. Oh. I mean, yes. They're old bulbs from the 50s and very much 1984, I felt. A lot of that faceless, you're just a number.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most people feel like that now. I mean, you know, how many bars do you go to where you're not recognised and I've been coming here for 20 years? What do you mean? What do I want?
Exactly, that alienation. But the way that, the way that it was presented definitely felt very much like, and not only films like Brazil, those classic 80s sort of...
Dystopian
things, but also, you know, it is based on a Dostoevsky story, and
that's important.
Totally, and that whole Russianness of it was very, very clear. So we were talking a little bit earlier on about how distinctive Eisenberg is as a character, and I was thinking, how's he going to play a different version of himself? Doesn't he? Isn't he always the same?
But he does.
He manages it. Yeah, really lovely, very measured. Very measured differences between those two characters, even though they're dressed exactly the same.
I thought, I don't want to meet the Facebook guy again.
And
I thought that's what he does, you know.
I would say that both of these films have real problems in terms of the female characters, like not having any, really. Mia Wasikowska plays the object of his affection in The Double and really is just an object of... his affection.
Well, it's a navel-gazing. They're both navel-gazing, isn't it? They're both the Dostoevsky thing, which is what he writes about, isn't it? It's the self. Mm. It's obsession with the self. So other poor old women don't really get a look at it. It's like, sorry, good coffee?
Yeah.
I'm busy obsessing.
Exactly. So of the two films, The Double is the funnier. Pretty much because that's what it's meant to be.
Wallace Shawn, the great Wallace Shawn.
And there's a fantastic cast. At one point you yelled out, "That's Jay Maskus."
Yeah, Jay Maskus from
Dinosaur Jr. He's just playing the janitor.
He looks like Alf with long hair. You know, no one will know what that is.
That's a very obscure reference there, won't you? But yeah, so the double, you know, it was good.
There's a lovely Noah Taylor as well.
Yeah, really good character actor.
Speaking in his own accent, which he doesn't get to do very much these days.
Denis Villeneuve's enemy. Now, this is a much, much more glossy movie.
The sheer presence of Jake Gyllenhaal probably would have meant that their funding was a lot
higher.
But
also that's Denis Villeneuve's style, you know. For me, this is another fantastic example of Denis Villeneuve basically over-egging whatever it is that he's got going for him. Like, I had real problems with Enemy. Stylish, beautifully shot. He's got a fantastic director's ability to make scenes work.
Mm.
Individual scenes, you go, ooh, tension. Well,
we don't want to spoil anything, but the opening sequence, you go, well, where are we going here? We go, like a bit of Eyes Wide Shut there. Yeah. A bit of Kubrick. I felt
exactly.
Sadly, never realised.
No, and that's what I felt with Prisoners, which is his more recent film, and I certainly felt it with Dan Sandys.
Really interesting.
He's writing checks that his stories can't cash, you know, and this is...
Harsh words.
It is.
Kayleigh's
blushing. Well, you know, you don't have to agree or disagree with this, but I really think of the two, the more satisfying cinema experience would be the double if you have to choose between
them. Because, in a way, it has more humour, I think. And that kind
and
of
a little
gets
bit more soul to it, you know, maybe as a result. Jake Gyllenhaal, really, really good.
Oh, he's a lovely actor, you know.
Yeah, and does a fantastic job of the differences, of the subtle differences between the two characters that he's playing. Villeneuve is just a fantastic director, but I just don't know if he's got the story sense, you know, to justify the talent that he's got.
But to be fair, to sum up, both films in their own way quite compelling for me anyway.
They also reinforced each other. Like, they were more interesting having watched them both together than they would have been if I'd watched them a week apart.
And there is a lot of thematically that's interesting, because we were talking about that film called Jake, weren't we, a New Zealand film. That idea of substitution, that idea of doppelgangers, that idea that we can be replaced easily. It's funny, you know, where we're just becoming numbers and we have credit cards, you can walk past things and pay for them. You know, all that, you know, are we losing that ability to have you even in the room? I mean... Yeah, I don't know
exactly. Well, it's definitely the zeitgeist at the moment.
On a much more serious note,
Big Men. Now, this is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen.
Wow,
this was seriously a really, really
big ups, bro.
Good documentary. Really well. Over a long period of time, this film follows the development of an offshore oil field off the coast of Ghana in the Niger Delta, in that sort of that corner of the world.
In Africa,
yes, exactly. And the very first time that oil has been discovered in Ghana, best known for its chocolate up to now, right? And the biggest export. And so the people of Ghana, the government of Ghana, extremely keen on the potential money that this is going to bring them, but also not wanting to end up like Nigeria, their neighbours, who have basically been completely ripped off. They've been ripped off by their government. They've been ripped off by the oil industry. That, you know, it's actually everywhere in Africa that oil has been discovered, things have got worse for everybody. And so this is a film that it does the really weird thing, is that it makes you feel sorry for a middle-sized oil company, because a company called Kosmos, you know, there's only 20 people work for them, and they're based out of Dallas, and they've taken this punt and discovered this oil, and they need partners. They need really big money to be able to develop it, and they need the Ghanaian government to help them out, and they get sort of screwed by all sides.
Yeah.
And you think, it's hard to feel sorry for you losing a couple of billion dollars here, you guys, but, you know...
Maybe they were going to do it in a good way.
Well, I don't think it's possible. They're oil men, right? But it's still... It is interesting. And the main thesis of the film, basically, which is that everybody in the industry, everybody in the world, has the same philosophy that African men do, which is they want to be big men. You know, they want more money so they can be big men. And how do they demonstrate how they're big men? By spending money and splashing it around and giving it away, etc.
Which is probably no different than anywhere else in the world.
Well, I think that's what the film is saying, is that, and there's just scale. Yeah. It's all just a matter of scale. And so the Cosmos guys in Dallas, they want to be big men on their own terms. And then they find that they're playing in a sand pit that has Exxon Mobil in it. And there's one fantastic scene where the big crash of 2007 has happened, and the price of oil has gone from $100 a barrel to $40 a barrel, and they basically are going to have to sell. They're going to have to sell their company to somebody who has the resources to be able to do what they want to do. And they're sitting around a table and going, look, why are we waiting? Why are we discussing things with ExxonMobil? Why don't we just whisper in their ear how much we'll take? And then they'll go and open the safe and say, what do you want, 20s or 10s? And, you know? And it's
Because huge companies can absorb those losses, but
they can survive for 10, 15 years on those ebbs and flows, but little guys can't do it. I thought it was absolutely fantastic, brilliantly constructed, and very, very interesting documentary, Big Men.
We are the best.
Oh, we ambitious are the title. Best. It's a very ambitious title, and this is Lucas Moodysson, one of the great European directors, and back on real crowd-pleasing form. And this is about a pair of friends. What age would they be, Katie? They'd be, what, 12?
12 or 13.
Yeah, 12 or 13. And this is set in the very early 1980s in Sweden, and they sort of find themselves with the opportunity to... they luck into a practice room at the local youth centre, and they sort of have to start a band in order to keep the practice room, and they just discover punk. And they love punk music. They're not particularly interested in playing well or writing proper songs.
Well, that's the punk ethos.
It is, exactly.
I don't know, I thought Hate the Sport was pretty great.
It's a great song. But what's great is that it gets punk. It totally gets the punk ethos. At the same time, it gets what being a 12-year-old is all about as well. Like, it's just a fantastically rewarding, funny, sensitive, brilliant. I'm not sure what that noise is, but anyway, it's probably something going on outside. Anyway, that it just gets the vibe in a way that so many films don't get.
No, that's on your computer.
It's the computer, is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, well, I'll turn that off. I'll turn the speakers off. And we'll see if that makes any better. Anyway.
You can't stop the music. No bug can stop them.
Anyway, so that's we are the best. Terrific film.
And last but definitely not least, the Fishhead sponsored film Kimiko the Treasure Hunter.
Well, we've kind of talked about this one, haven't we? About how good we think it is, and this is
that's it. It's good. Go see it.
Exactly. Time is marching on. This is a film about a lonely Japanese woman who, on a treasure hunt, discovers a VHS, a beaten-up, old, abandoned VHS tape of Fargo, the Coen brothers' film, takes it home and believes that she has actually discovered a treasure map, because if you remember Fargo, there's $1 million buried in the snow that nobody finds at the end of that film.
No, that gets lost in the kind of character milieu.
That's right. So there's $1 million, and so she counts the number of fence posts from the street and realizes that, you know, if she triangulates correctly, she could find this $1 million.
Wow, it's got an echo of Forgotten Silver in a way.
Yeah, believing a film to be real.
A friend of mine who actually said, you know, we were working on Shortland Street at the time. I won't name the actor, but he said to me, we've got to get a plane, we're going down, we're going to find this lost city, you know, that in Forgotten Silver, Peter Jackson's film, you know, talks about, in my opinion, his greatest work.
Yeah.
You know, it talks about, you know, New Zealand has invented, just something tapped into it, that we'd love to have believed that we invented cinema and had these beautiful cities.
So she...
Your film. Yeah,
sorry. Well, this film. So she basically flies to Minnesota.
To Fargo,
and well, not just Fargo. She gets to whatever the city you fly into, and then has to get a bus and a taxi to get the rest of the way. Anyway,
and she doesn't speak English very well. She knows is Fargo.
Yeah, she doesn't speak English very well.
Where's she from?
Japan. She's from Tokyo.
Right.
And so basically, the first half of the film feels like a Japanese movie. The second half of the film feels like you're watching an Alexander Payne movie. You know, this kind of fish out of water on the flat Badlands of Nebraska or whatever, the Midwest, and it just builds really beautifully to a kind of inevitable conclusion. It is one of the it's the kind of film that only a film festival can launch. You know, you wouldn't, if that just turned up, you wouldn't take any notice of it. But hopefully a reputation out of the film festival will mean that it'll get a really good audience, and then it'll have a life afterwards, because Kumiko the Treasure Hunter and David Zellner, the Zellner brothers, definitely names to watch.
And of course, we always encourage you to go see as many festival films as you can and send in your two-word reviews to Rancho Podcast. And yeah,
Have you still got your script? Because I gave I gave you the rest of it.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Because I do too much talking in
review,
the show.
The two-word review. I remember there was a quote from a musical in the '70s. That's how old I am. And it was for a musical called Yes, and the one-word review was No.
Yep. That's good. If only we were that pithy.
Is the information on here correct? I can read this if you like.
Pretty much.
Cool. That's our show for this week. Next week might actually be a sensible move health-wise for us to take a week off.
Yeah, pretty much that's the advice I've been getting from everybody is to stop doing stuff.
Yes. So we'll be back in a fortnight with an interview with Cliff Curtis and James Rolleston from The Dark Horse and a review of the very same film. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find a way to communicate with us via email or make a comment. We are now live in the iTunes store. Our iPhone and Android apps are not very far away.
They might actually be done by now. I haven't checked.
Oh, wow. Keep your eyes peeled for those.
Yeah.
They won't be free, by the way. Our provider is making us charge a minimum of 99 cents, but I am sure you can handle the 99 cents, people.
Yep.
All about the Rancho Notorious love. You can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast, all one word. We'll be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting and lots of giveaways that are happening around the film festival right now. Mm-hmm. Just a hot tip. And you can interact with us on Letterboxd too, username Rancho Notorious.
And there are a few people that we need to thank, people who made the show possible. So this show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Quere, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. We also want to thank Sue Tyler, who is producing badges for everybody who pledged.
Is that Sue?
We are getting we're getting Rancho Notorious badges for everybody who pledged, and all of our guests are going to get one.
I want a badge. I still want a badge.
It's like it'd be like Blue Peter back in the day. The theme music to the show is Ennio Morricone's "The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly" by Los Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music, and this is Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And
which one is it, Dan?
Well, this will be the one that when it turned up in the film, I went, oh yeah, that's right, that's great. Anyway, the other person that I really want to say thank you to is my partner Karen, who is preparing dinner for us as we speak. So we're off to have some roast chicken.
Ooh, yum.
Thanks very much to Johnny. It's been a pleasure having you here at Rancho Notorious.
Thank you for having me, and I'll leave you one quote that I always loved, my favourite movie quote there. It was Cockneys versus Zombies. This was the film, and the quote was, "The undead are brown bread."
That is a great tagline. That's good night from me, Dan Slavin.
And good night from me, a very confused Kaylee.